We're going to do a panel discussion on steps 8 and 9. So stick around for that. But before we do that, we're going to quickly open the meeting with the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. All right, so for panel 5 on steps 8 and 9, I'd like to introduce our chairperson, Nikki G. from Tucson, Arizona.
Hi, everyone. My name's Nikki. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Nikki. Hi, Nikki.
Welcome to the Step 8 and 9 panel of the Fellowship of the Spirit Easter Lockdown. I ask that we all observe a few moments silence to reflect upon our primary purpose and the still sick and suffering alcoholic and their family members, both inside and outside the rooms.
We have three speakers for this panel. Each has been provided with a reading upon which we have asked them to share their experience for 15 minutes. Each panel will be followed by a 30-minute Q&A session. Please send your questions via the chat function on your Zoom display when prompted, and we will attempt to get through as many of those as possible. Our first reading comes from page 76 of the Big Book. Now we need more action, without which we find that faith without works is dead. Let's look at steps 8 and 9. We have a list of all persons we have harmed and to whom we are willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. We subjected ourselves to a drastic self-appraisal. Now we go out to our fellows and repair the damage done in the past. We attempt to sweep away the debris which has accumulated out of our effort to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. If we haven't the will to do this, we ask until it comes. Remember, it was agreed at the beginning we would go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. And I would now like to introduce Charlie P. from Austin, Texas, who will share for 15 minutes.
All right. Hi, everybody. I'm Charlie Parker. I'm alcoholic. Let me get some of these screens off of here because it's really distracting when you got all those people on the screen and they're eating the sandwiches. And okay, I'm really happy to be here. My name is Charlie. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is March 22nd of 1985. And some of you just got to hear my little shrinking violet of a bride, Katie, give her story. And good job, Katie. Really enjoyed it. I've heard her. I've heard her talk many times, and I still just love it. I was there for a lot of it, and she does have 5 months more sobriety than I do. So sometimes in our house, if I'm struggling, she likes to say, "Honey, just stick around for about 5 and a half more months, and it'll start to make a lot more sense to you." But AA is alive and well in our house, and I just love it. It's really an honor to get to come to this Fellowship of the Spirit Easter Lockdown group. I wish I could turn my camera around and show you the view out the front of my house. It's a beautiful day in Austin, Texas today, but all I can tell you is the last time I was on lockdown, it didn't have a view quite like this. I've been locked down before, but under much different circumstances. You know, we've done several of the Fellowship of the Spirit events, and I got kind of linked into this crew through Mark Houston, and I'm a big fan of the whole Don Pritz, Gary Brown lineage of AA. But you know, it's kind of funny. I was telling Gary earlier, you know, I had my biggest spiritual awakening at 17 years of sobriety, and I remember when I was having this big experience with Myers and Chris and then Mark Houston and some of those guys that listened to the talks and find out there was people doing AA on a much different level than anything I had experienced before. And, I remember at one point thinking, God, I wish there'd been somebody in my life, you know, that was bringing this big book message when I was new or sober, so I wouldn't have had to struggle for 17 years and blow up all these marriages and everything. And then one time I was at this conference, and there's this conference in Texas called the Lakeside Conference. And it's the second oldest conference in the United States. And on their brochure every week, they show, they list all the speakers from all the years. And it's really kind of interesting. And I was reading through it one time, and I looked back, and it said 1989, Don P., Aurora, Colorado. And I thought, wait a minute, I was here in 1989. And so I went to the taper, and I said, do you have that talk? And he sent me the CD, and I listened to it, and it was all there. I mean, everything that we talk about now that was so groundbreaking to me when I had 17 years was in that talk that I heard when I had 4 years of sobriety. And either I wasn't trying to hear it, or I was thinking about women or sandwiches or something. And so a lot of times when I hear people say, you know, nobody ever brought that message, I'm always like, well, there's also a very good chance that I just wasn't trying to hear it. But for whatever reason, I'm a big fan of that. And I met Mary Thayer at that conference right after Mark died. And I'll never forget, she was talking, and after her talk, I went up to her and I said, you and I have some common language, and I hope that we can figure out what it is this week, because of the language of the heart, I could feel it when she was talking. And she named something, and the second name she said was Don Pretz. And we're like, there it is. And it just, I missed Mark so bad at the time. I got emotional more than once talking to her, because I could feel that lineage of AA coming. You know, and it's funny when you know, I got asked to do this thing on 8 and 9, and it's a real honor. And they say, you wouldn't publicize this normally from the podium, but a lot of times when they say you're on a panel, or you're going to be chairing a workshop with this person, your first thought is like, well, who's this other person going to be? Because it's not always a good match when they put you with somebody. So Damon, I said, who are the other two people I want to be on the panel with? And he said, Mary Thayer and Gary Brown. I was like, good grief. I mean, I think I'll just listen, you know. I mean, I could sit up here and juggle and tell jokes, and it would be awesome today, you know. So it's a real honor. That's high company in my book, and I'm a big fan of those guys. And I just want to make a couple of quick points. Oh, darn it, I forgot to turn on my timer. I'm not sure how long I've been going, but I'll guess at it. So in the hour and a half I have left, there's a couple of points I want to make. You know, when I say I had my big spiritual awakening at 17 years, sometimes I like to talk about what was the difference between the experience I had then and the experience, you know, it was kind of like what I was like, what happened then, what happened, and what I'm like now. And what's the difference between that first 17 years in AA and the last 18 years in AA? Because I almost missed it, you know. And so some of the big experiences is kind of like what I like to talk about. When I came in the first time, you know, I worked the steps. I thought I was a big book guy. My home group was a Tuesday night big book study meeting. Katie and I met when I had 6 months and she had a year. And when she says we were best friends, I mean, like brother and kid sister. And I loved her from the minute I met her. But it changed a lot after Joe died. And trying to take that best friend, pulling the pigtails energy into a relationship, was kind of a tough transition. But anyway, that's not what we're talking about. But she got to see a lot of my early AA, and she knew all my wives, and I've been married several times in AA. I think I've proven that I'm not afraid to commit. But she didn't approve of all the relationships I was in, and she's seeing all this stuff. And you know, but my first pass through the amends process, if I'm a tornado roaring its way through the lives of others, my first amends were kind of like the first people that would have been hit by that tornado. You know, so it was my mom, my sister, my dad, and then some of the people where I could have gotten in big trouble, you know, like the IRS, and Delta Airlines, and some of those. But I was amazed before I was halfway through, you know, as the book says. And I pulled away. I wish I had time to tell more of the story, but in 7 years of sobriety, I'd already blown up 2 marriages. I got 2 kids on the ground. I got 2 child support checks going out the door. And it's not the way I would have designed my life to look. And I'm thinking, you know, I've tried it your way, and I'm getting knocked to the mat every time I step into the ring. I'll show you what half measures will get me. And I kind of pulled away from some parts of AA. I was still very much about staying sober, but I kind of lightened up on the rigorous honesty piece of some of the stuff. I used to call it a flat period in my sobriety. Now I call it, it was untreated alcoholism, it was not the period of my sobriety that I would have wanted had sent into the General Service Office as an example of how a 18, 20 year member of Alcoholics Anonymous should live, towards the end of that life, I had some really life changing experiences. And Katie mentioned the plane crash. I was in a plane crash. We crashed into the water at night on a little chartered Cessna 210. There was five adults and my dog. And we crashed into the water. It was dark. It was July 20th of 03. But it's a long story, but spoiler alert, I didn't die. But it changed a lot of things about the way I looked at things. I started looking at my program differently. And I came back and I started kind of looking at what was missing in my life. And I called up an old timer here, and instead of meeting me and talking about the depth of my problems, he says, come over tomorrow, we'll go out to the treatment center and talk to the new guys. And you know what's funny? When you're in trouble and somebody recommends service work, it never really seems like that's going to do it. I wanted to talk about me, but next thing you know, we're going out there, and I started having a new experience, and I started studying the book. My ego wanted to have answers for these guys. And Mark used to say you can put the ego to work for good cause. And I was like, you might stump me with that question once, but not more than once. And I'll get the answer to that question. It felt like I was a step ahead of these guys sometimes, but I started doing a different level of work with Myers and Chris and a friend of mine in Dallas. And like Katie said, I'm dragging her around to all these meetings. Because when I say we almost lost Katie, I mean, it breaks my heart to think about the pain she was in at that time and how things have just fallen around her shoulders. And we're going to all these meetings. We're working the steps. And we go to this workshop with Mark. And it was so odd because Mark Houston went silent for 3 years one time. He didn't do any talks for 3 years. And for some reason, we got a hold of this flyer saying that Mark was doing a workshop up in Denton. And we drive 230 miles to go up to this conference. And it was just, I had to take Monday off that Monday because my mind was blown. I meditated more that weekend that I had in my first 17 years of sobriety. And there was one point, Katie and I are front pew sitters. We were right there on the front row. And there was one point where I leaned over to Katie and I said, what book is he reading from? Because, he was coming with stuff that I had never heard before. And I thought I was a big book guy. So when we say, how do you know what you don't know? How could I possibly know what I don't know? And I talk a lot about this confirmation bias. When I would read the book, I wasn't looking for new information. I was looking for confirmation of ways I was already right, looking for confirmation of things I already knew. So I can drag my ego through this process and come out the other end completely untouched. So when Mark wound up moving to Austin, and when he did, I asked him if he'd sponsor me. And this first meeting with Mark, I'm getting to the eighth and ninth step, I swear to God. When Mark came to the first meeting at the house, I started a group a little bit before that called The Common Solution. And it was me and my guys sitting at the table. It started off, it was me, Mark Houston, and all my sponsees. We wanted to be one voice, one message. So whoever you were talking to in our crew, you should be getting roughly the same message of Alcoholics Anonymous. The first meeting that Mark comes to, my boys are all excited because they're like, Charlie's got a new sponsor. What's this going to be like? Because they know it rolls downhill and whatever experience I'm having. If I'm going down, I'm taking you down with me. And so they're like, what kind of experience are we about to have with this guy, Mark? And he comes to sit at the table. And at the first meeting, I figure we're probably going to talk about inventory or something like that. But he sits down at the table and he says, where are you guys at? Where are you at in the amends process? And we said, what alcoholics say when they don't have a good answer and they need a minute to think. I said, what? And he goes, where are you guys at with the amends process? And I tried to BS my way through it, but it was weak. It was obviously weak. And he says, You know, I sense that there's a significant experience available for you, man, in the amends process. And we were like, this guy is like Svengali or something. It's like, how could he possibly know that there's a significant experience available for us in the amends process? It's because nearly all of us have a significant experience in the amends process. And, you know, so we started doing the work together, and Mark was all about it. I mean, and you know, and one of the things we talked about is, you know, there's a two big words in the eighth step. It says, we made a list of all people we have harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And you know, there's a lot of good reasons to make amends to some of the people on my list, but there's really only one reason to make amends to all the people that I've harmed, and that's because I think it has something to do with my connection with God, and I think it has something to do with whether or not I stay sober. We would tie it to our first step experience. And, you know, do you want to make these amends? No, not particularly. Well, would you rather make these amends or drink vodka? And when, if those really are my two choices, die an alcoholic death, live life on a spiritual basis, well, then let's talk about making these amends. And so, you know, the funny thing about AA that I've noticed over the years is that when you start talking about the amends process in mainstream oral tradition AA, the bulk of the advice in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous is geared towards not having to make the amends. If you've got amends you don't want to make, all you got to do is get a weak sponsor or go to the big clubhouse, and somebody will tell you why you don't have to make these amends. And you know, it's like, once you get on the other side of it, you're like, why would we hold somebody back for this? But, you know, the amends process is not something we do for extra credit. It's two of our 12 steps, you know, but you go to, and people go, oh, you don't have to do that. You have to, you know, making those amends could harm. It says not to do it if they'll harm you or others and harm others. And you're part of others. So, yeah, just keep it, and, you know, that is not at all. The book says the rule is that we're to be hard on ourselves and easy on others. So obviously I'm not part of others. And, you know, and I had a meeting, I did a meeting one time where we talked about making direct amends to whatever people we've harmed. And I got a sponsor in there and I go, watch people change the topic, avoid the topic, or tell you why they don't have to do it. And at the end of the meeting, he said, man, if you hadn't told me it was going to happen, I would have never believed it, because nobody wanted to talk about making direct amends to the people they have harmed. But all the inspirational stories, you're going to hear stories from Gary coming up. Gary, for my money, has the best amends experience. Him and Julie have the best amends experience you'll ever hear from a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. But, you know, when we started making these amends, and I'm almost finished, but we started taking the amends and transferring them onto cards. Take them off the list and transfer them onto cards. And I put the nature of the harm and who I'm harming. And I have three questions I put on there. Have I harmed you in any other way? Because as self-centered as I am, I may not be aware of all the ways that I've harmed you or the effect. And then the second one, and then after each question, we say, shut up and listen. Have I harmed you in any other way? Shut up and listen. Is there anything I could do to help make this right? Shut up and listen. And the third question is, do you need to tell me how this made you feel? And shut up and listen. And those can blow that amend so much deeper. But, you know, I guess one of the biggest experiences I've had in the amends process since then was I got all my guys in my circle of guys, and I said, boys, let's all make a list of our amends that we need to make, gather next Thursday, and read them to each other. I had no idea how powerful that was going to be, because we all got together. We all had spiritual consent with each other. But when you started talking about your amends list, my amends list got longer. You know, I wound up making some powerful amends to Katie, and she got with me later, and she had 32 items on her list. They were all legitimate harms. I said, had I harmed you in any other way? When she came back, she had 32 items. They were all valid amends, and none of them made my list. That's the power of those questions. You know, it finishes off by saying that these extravagant promises after the nine-step promises, and They really are extravagant promises. We say we think not, but only the people on this side of a spiritual awakening think they're not extravagant promises. It says they're being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. If you're not in the amends process, get in the amends process. Get with somebody that has experience with it, and you won't believe what will happen to your life. Thanks for listening to me. I love you, God.
Thank you so much, Charlie. Sorry, I needed to get my microphone unmuted. thank you.